Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Our producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. We're also pleased to have back here on the program once again Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist, specializes in dealing with women's health. She has practice here in our area. She teaches at the U of I Med School, and every other month she is on the program, and we talk about women's health. And a long time ago, we thought this would be a good thing to have on a recurring basis so that people who listen to the program would know there would be this regular opportunity to ask questions, and that's what we're all about. Now, she usually comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new, perhaps some things that have been in the news or that she's become aware of, and we're going to do that. But I also want to make sure that people who are listening know that it is an opportunity to ask questions. So things that have to do with her special area of practice, and it's very wide. We've talked about a lot of different things with her over the years. Any of that, anything that you could think of asking an OBGYN, you can ask, and she'll do her best to answer your question, keeping in mind, of course, that we can't diagnose over the phone. The doctor can't see you, so that places some limit on what we can do. But the show is here for you to try to enhance your knowledge about health, and I know that she'll do her best to answer questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Well, also, of course, we do have that toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you can give us a call. Well, thanks for being here once again.
Good morning. Appreciate Thank it. You.
Well, there were a number of things that you said we might talk about. Well, what would you like to start with?
Well, I thought I would talk a little bit about a couple of our new research studies. As I told you, a couple of them that we have going. We are looking for a very limited patient set, and they're going to be closing fairly soon, so won't really be able to recruit too many patients. But I'm very excited to announce that we are starting to work with a group of researchers that are trying to develop a chlamydia vaccine and a herpes vaccine. So that would be very exciting because these mm-hmm. are very important diseases that cause a lot of morbidity, and it would be very exciting to try to prevent them. So for our herpes vaccine trial, which is actually going to be closing tomorrow, so somebody wanted to participate, they have to get over to my office today. But we are actually looking for what we call discordant couples. So someone who might have a partner that they've had for over 6 months where the partner actually has a herpes simplex type 2 and gets outbreaks, but they themselves do not get outbreaks. So maybe their partner is on suppressive medication, or maybe their partner does not get frequent outbreaks, but for whatever reason, they have not contracted an active case of herpes. And we would like to draw their blood to see if they've developed immunity to herpes or they just simply have not gotten it at all. And it's the first phase of vaccine development, and we're excited about that. And with our chlamydia vaccine trial, we are also looking for patients who they themselves have had chlamydia infections, either had a tubal factor infertility or developed pelvic inflammatory disease secondary to the chlamydia organism. And we would like to study their blood for antibodies. And, of course, when people participate in clinical trials, we do pay them for their time. And so we do compensate them a little bit mm-hmm. for their blood draw in this pretty simple, straightforward study where you come in and we consent the patient to participate and draw some blood. And that's pretty much it. Some patients we will want to get a second blood draw, but for most patients, it's going to be a single blood draw.
Yeah, I'm just curious now because, you know, we have talked off and on, and maybe later on we'll talk about the vaccine for the human papilloma virus,
yes.
HPV. And you were just talking about here now research on a couple of other vaccines. They're early. It's early days on this.
Very early.
For the HPV vaccine, how long did it take to develop that?
Well, that is a very good question. You're probably asking about the Gardasil vaccine,
yes.
which you may or may not know that there's also the Cervarix vaccine that has become FDA approved. Gardasil is a quadrivalent vaccine against four different types of the HPV virus. Cervarix is just going to be a cervical cancer vaccine, type 16 and 18. So there's going to be some differences there. But I think we began our initial investigations at least 10 years before it became approved. And actually, for a vaccine trial, that was quick. Mm-hmm. They had done so much work with what's called the adjuvant, the thing that is the HPV viral-like particle is in a suspension that makes it a vaccine. That adjuvant at Merck was already used in their hepatitis vaccines and some of the others. So they had done so much work on that adjuvant that I think that helped them in their trials. And the effectiveness of that vaccine was so rapidly proven. Within the first shot, we can show that patients are protected against abnormal pap smears and against genital warts. And within the first year of the vaccination, we can show they're protected against developing dysplasia, and we showed cost effectiveness. So it was so radically effective compared to other medical therapies that actually, once it got into their phase three trials, that was quite fast. But yes, it takes a long time. Mm. So from the stage we're at with the chlamydia and the herpes vaccine trials, it's going to be a little bit.
All right. Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's on the program every other month on a Monday, and we talk about women's health. So it's your opportunity to ask questions. We have someone ready to go in St. Joe, so let's talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have MS and am nearing menopause, and I have some concerns, I guess. One thing, I'm very heat sensitive with my MS. You know, any kind of fever or if I'm out in the sun for any period of time makes my symptoms much worse at that time. So I'm very concerned about hot flashes. You know, I know they're just a flash, but I'm not sure if it's enough to worsen, your MS at that time. And also, I just wondered what your experience has been related to people with MS and menopause. And thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Well, hot flashes themselves have had so many different nicknames. The medical term for the neurologic symptoms around the time of menopause are called vasomotor symptoms. And we think that their origin are actual brain surges of the hormone LH, which comes from the pituitary gland. And we don't exactly know why some women have very mild symptoms and some women have very intense symptoms. By definition, from the FDA and all the clinical trials, we've kind of set a cutoff of moderate to severe of being about 7 of these events per day or 49 or more per week. So when we do clinical trials, that's sort of where we set our cutoff, and we sort of set that as our cutoff for someone who needs therapy. And other than that, we say that they are quote-unquote mild. We think that most women will have at least mild symptoms, but there apparently is a genetic predisposition. Certain ethnicities seem to have much worse. Certain ethnicities seem to have very few. Certain cultures, there are certain languages that don't even have words for these terms, for instance, and we think in our American population, only about 3% of the population literally say, I transitioned through my menopause and I did not have any symptoms at all. We think that various medical conditions can worsen those symptoms at the time of menopause. We know inactivity can worsen the symptoms, so that people with neurologic conditions, if they go through periods of time where they're very inactive, they will be worse. So when they study groups of patients, for instance, with MS, if they go through a very symptomatic phase where they're very inactive, that can be a problem. If they are on certain medications, yes, those medications can be a problem. If that group of patients is overweight, overweight patients tend to have more symptoms, which is a little bit different than the older literature. The older literature used to suggest that older patients have higher levels of estrogen. They should have less symptoms. But you can think of somebody as very heavy, kind of like wearing a fur coat, you're warmer. And so someone who has a higher, who is warmer has a higher problem with it. We don't really exactly know what causes the sensation of heat, but we term it as a narrower set point. Without my blackboard, it's very hard to describe. But this is the way you think about it. So we all sit around in a certain thermal zone where we feel comfortable. If our body temperature goes too much higher than that thermal zone, so you draw a high line of a temperature, then you sweat. If your body temperature goes too much lower than a certain temperature, you freeze. So draw your lower line and put a temperature there. Okay, in menopause, women who have these vasomotor symptoms sweat at a lower, so move that top line down and put a different number, and you might know what your number is. So let's say you normally sweat when your internal temperature gets up to, just make something up, 101. Well, now maybe you normally sweat when your internal temperature gets to, say, 98. And let's say you normally shiver when your internal temperature gets down to, say, 94. But now you normally are going to shiver when your internal temperature gets to 97. Well, this is what happens to people. So instead of having this super wide normal temperature zone, you have this super narrow temperature zone, so that just normal room fluctuations, normal fluctuations when you just are walking briskly around the block, your just normal activity can generate a little bit of a body temperature fluctuation that sets off this, just makes your neurologic set point go above it or below it. And so you flash or you freeze.
Well,
hopefully
now,
somebody followed that.
I'm well, here now, again, is my question. Pardon me if this is sort of a dumb question, but okay. So you have a woman and you say, okay, you tell me when you're having a hot flash. She says, okay, now, if you take her temperature right. At that moment, has her body temperature actually gone up?
For some people, no. Her internal temperature hasn't really changed that much, but her set points, how she responds to it, has.
So,
but now,
yeah.
For some people, your response changes. Uh-huh. So you're okay. Let's say you got her all hooked up in the lab. So her internal temperature hasn't really changed, but her response has. So her flush changes, her sweat changes, her shiver changes. So how she responds to it has. But her internal temperature hasn't changed, but those neurologic, our hippocampus, our internal brain centers that I tried to fall asleep in those lectures, came back to haunt me. I had to learn all those higher brain centers. But some of them are brain stem, our lower brain centers, actually. But those, how we respond to that changes. And it has something to do with this menopause transition. It has something to do with the withdrawal of estrogen. Because when we add estrogen back, we replace that. We become stable. And once again, we go into our normal set point. So we aren't always a perfect temperature. We do sweat. We do shiver. if we get into climates that are different. We do have core responses that are different. If we sit in a hot tub really long or go into the high hotel or whatever a long time, we will change.
Okay. Well, and I don't, maybe this is a question that would be better addressed by someone who is a specialist in dealing with something like MS. But do you know, is this likely to cause for someone like the caller, and again, knowing nothing about her medical history, is going through menopause and the kind of thing that we're talking about, would that complicate her systems or her symptoms, or would that particularly be a problem?
With most neurologic diseases, yes, going through menopause usually complicates things, but not in every case, because some people have a very smooth transition, and a lot depends on how she is going to go through menopause. And, our caller didn't say her age and that sort of thing. She said she was nearing. And we don't know what her transition's going to be. Some people have a very smooth transition. Some people will have a solid 8 or 10 years. If we look at fertility, there's about a 13-year period of time where we go from consistently ovulating to not ovulating at all. So if we look fertility-wise, we're actually in a 13-year decline. So actually looking at how her MS changed during that early, early, early transition might give her a clue. So it depends. It depends on how severe a case she has, how much she's able to use exercise and things like that to head off her symptoms.
Okay. Well, I hope that helps. Certainly the caller can call back if she would like to, and anyone who has a question can call in. If you'd like to talk with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopin, she's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's on the program every other month, always on a Monday, to talk about women's health. And if you have a question, you can call 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe because we had been talking just a little bit earlier, you were talking about some of the research that you were doing on herpes and chlamydia, and then we just touched really briefly on the HPV vaccine. Something that, and you mentioned the fact that it seems like every time we talk about this, almost every time we talk about it, the subject of the Gardasil and things like that, and boys. Comes
boys.
Up. So because it's now recommended for girls, and the question has been, well, maybe it would be a good idea if we were also vaccinating boys. Where are we with that?
Well, the FDA is looking at that information, and that's been publicized for quite a while. There have been a few new articles that have come out specifically looking at males and their acquisition of the HPV virus over their sojourn during college. And sure enough, males are acquiring the HPV virus not only in their genital region, specifically on their penis, but actually even on their hands, under their fingernails. So even touching during sexual contact can transmit viruses, which is why people with same-sex partners can transmit the virus to each other, and why people who haven't had intercourse can actually come up with abnormal pap smears or genital warts, and why we feel it's so critical to initially get the population vaccinated when they're very young before this type of contact takes place, and then vaccinate everyone as they go through. Boys have been vaccinated in Australia since the vaccine was introduced. There are some countries where HPV vaccination of boys has started to take place in Europe, and we are hoping that the FDA will look at the efficacy of vaccinating boys and hopefully look at all aspects of vaccinating boys. The prevention of penile cancer, the prevention of warts, as well as the prevention of transmission of HPV and to a potential female partner someday. And I think that it's very important. We went through one phase in the late 80s, early 90s, where we were actually doing, we called it androscopy rather than colposcopy, actually looking at male partners for subclinical evidence of HPV disease when a patient had persistent abnormal pap smears. And it's starting to look like from the literature that that might be important. So in our practice, we're starting to discuss that with our patients again. And another physician in my practice is starting to do the androscopies again for us. So it's getting to be a huge topic. There's a new company that just got their HPV test, new test approved, the Digene hybrid test, test 13 types of HPV, and the new test, and I believe it's going to be called, it's a name just like Cervivax, which is the name of the competing vaccine. It's Cervax, I think. It's going to be a very similar name. We have a little trouble with that in medicine. A lot of names are very similar, but there's going to be a new HPV test that's going to test for 14 different types of HPV. So some people have been tested and told they were negative for the HPV virus, might want to consider retesting once this new test is available. So tremendous amount of new information out there.
Yeah, okay. Well, we have some other callers. Let's talk next with someone in Vermilion County on line one.
Good morning. Someone called me and said you had been talking about the topic of body temperature, comfort, and hormones. And I'd like you to talk a little bit more about that, if you would. Specifically, I live a perfectly normal life, except that I wear many more layers of clothing indoors in the wintertime, particularly than my friends do. I wear like about four layers, including long johns and a couple of sweater-type layers over. And I've had, this was a case prior to menopause, post-menopause, and post-surgery after menopause, which removed ovaries and uterus. Are there any hormonal, either thyroid or other, sort of normal bandwidths that are different that should be checked? I can certainly live with this just by wearing the layers, but people keep telling me, well, you have so many layers. Why do you do this?
Well, again, it depends. It depends on how clinically stable you really are, like how healthy are your bones and, you know, what's your muscle mass and how much do you exercise and, you know, how many carbs do you eat and what's your weight? And there are so many things like that. And your body fat percentage could be checked and your levels of testosterone could be checked. Absolutely. Some of the subtle aspects of your thyroid gland could be checked. Some of your subtle aspects of your adrenal gland might affect it. But of course, there just are behaviors that we get used to. And, you know, we can, you know, it's just like people get used to working in hot houses and people get used to working in colder environments. And it may literally, in your case, be a habit that you've developed, or it could be something medical. So we can't always just say that it is that. People who swim for exercise, the water always is, you know, if you heat a pool, what's a hot pool? You know, normal pools keep them somewhere between, you know, 78 supposed to be, you know, a good competition pool temp, but a lot of, you know, Y's will keep their pool temp 80 to 82. But, you know, we're a lot warmer than that. So people who swim for exercise stay a little bit cooler. You talk to most swimmers, they wear a lot of layers when they don't work out because their body temp is just a little bit cooler just in general. So a lot has to do with what exercise you do. And, you know, their hormone levels are probably, you know, better than ours. And so it will vary a lot, but it is something that a physician could check.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you to another caller here. This listener is in Mahomet on line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for the show.
Mm-hmm.
I have had an experience lately with shingles, and I think the lasting symptoms are called post-herpetic neuralgia. I have that. And I don't ever want to do it again. It's just been awful. It's been going on for about 5 months now. And it's getting better all the time. But I know there's a vaccine out now for shingles. And I would just encourage anybody to get it. And what? How is that vaccine working out for people? And should I get it?
You can still get it. And I am a strong proponent of vaccines. I've already gotten my shingles vaccine. And I will say, though, that now don't quote me on price, but I would say off the top of my head, it's a little bit of an expensive vaccine. It's in the $350, $375 category, something like that. And my nurses are telling me it's one of the vaccines that's not so well covered. I think it's money very well spent. I know in my office and in my cosmetic medicine office, we do have care credits, the kind of thing that I would think that would be, you know, it's one of those medical interest-free loan kinds of things that you could pay off over time. I would think that is a very good expenditure of healthcare dollars, very worth it. I think the original guidelines are to... I think we got a little feedback there. I'm sorry. And I think the original guidelines were to give it at age 60 and above, but I think they're going to drop it to age 50. And I think same with pneumonia vaccine. I think the guidelines are 60, but now the newest guidelines are they're recommending the Pneumovax for any smokers. And they're recommending, I think they're going to drop that probably to 50, but any smokers are supposed to get the pneumonia vaccine. And I see that a lot of my smokers have not gotten that vaccine yet. But so some of those guidelines are changing. I think we're trying to do some catch-up vaccination with hepatitis A. A lot of people have had their hepatitis B. Travelers often have had hepatitis A. But a lot of my patients haven't gotten caught up yet on hepatitis A. And then the tetanus now, we're combining that with boosters for measles and so forth. CDC website has fabulous information about the vaccines, and I've designated one nurse in my office to kind of keep up with all this stuff and the prices and so forth, and she keeps pretty good records and has all the good handouts that she's downloaded from the CDC for patients. And people could always shoot us an email if they want to know the links and so forth.
Well, so again, for the shingles vaccine, the bottom line is, even if you've already had an attack of shingles,
you can get it
mm-hmm. and you can benefit from getting the vaccine. Otherwise, now the recommendation, and it is possible, you know, younger people do get it, but basically it tends to be something that older people get. So now the recommendation is that people over 60, but it's still, do you think that point is going to come when more health plans and HMOs are going to start to cover it?
I think so. I think it's very cost effective, but, you know, that's a question for your economist.
The thing about shingles, it's another herpes thing. It's caused by the same thing that causes chickenpox. Everybody gets chickenpox, although now that we're giving vaccination for that, maybe they'll come to a point where fewer people get chickenpox. But not everybody gets shingles. It's really unpleasant if you get it. But I guess the question would be, again, it goes back to this health, this benefit cost thing. And we say, well, if we give everybody the vaccine, that everybody's not going to get shingles even if we don't give the vaccine. But you think maybe they'll get to the point where they'll say, yes, the benefit is there. And even though it's going to be expensive, we're going to say anybody who wants it, you can get it.
I believe in it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And I guess the other thing that isn't known is, the question at one time was, okay, if we start vaccinating people for chickenpox and people don't get chickenpox, there was still this open question of, well, does that mean then they won't ever get shingles, or might they get shingles? And I kind of think the answer is, even though you get the vaccine for chickenpox, you might still get shingles. Is that correct?
I think if you got enough immunity that you never got contagious with that, you would never get that.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess that's it. Next time, Dr. Jeff, our family practice doctor, maybe the next time he's here, we better go over.
Yeah, you better go over that with him. All right. In case I gave anybody the wrong info.
Okay. The questions here and champagne. We have two callers. We'll take line one first. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, Susan, I got a question for you. I would like for you to explain to people what lupus is, because I've had many, many people think that it's STD, and I just want to hear your comments, and I'm going to hang up, and maybe you can explain that to the public. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Well, lupus is not sexually transmitted.
No, it's not. It's in the rheumatic disease categories, and it can have various manifestations from a joint disease to a kidney disease to a skin disease. And when we say STD, the initials stand for sexually transmitted disease, and a lot of people in that genre of medicine tried to move it to being called an STI, sexually transmitted infection, trying to differentiate people that are carriers from people who are actively infected and diseased. And the STI lingo was kind of politically correct, but never caught on. So in the STD category, we try to think of something that is specifically transmitted infectiously versus a disease that, as far as we know, we just acquire. And there are those that say that many of the diseases that we get may be infectious in origin somehow that we don't know. Many cancers are infectious in origin, for instance. They may be viral. They may be bacterial. But they don't necessarily have to be sexually infectious. But at any rate, to my knowledge, lupus has no sexually transmitted basis.
Well, and even I guess I wouldn't, you know, I would want to make sure people didn't think that somehow if you lived with a person who has lupus,
that it's
you're
not
going to catch it from them. Yes.
No. Correct.
No. But from what you say, though, it is true that we really how lupus develops, why lupus develops, we really don't know.
Right.
Okay. Well, I hope that in part answers the question. Again, you know, maybe again next time we have a more general health conversation, we could talk about that as well. Let's go to line number two. This is also someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about severe menstrual pain. I'm 41, and generally on day three, I have severe pain that's debilitative. Yesterday, it was about 4 or 5 hours long. My doctor has prescribed an NSAID. NSAID, is that how you say that?
Sure.
And then she's told me I could layer Tylenol on top of that. And when we've talked about it, she said she's hesitant to prescribe anything else because we would be getting into another category of medication. And my question is this pain just something that I have to live with, or are there other things that could be done? I've been to the emergency room twice. The second time, by the time I got there, the cramps had subsided and I felt pretty silly. So I'm just wondering if there's anything else that I can do.
Well, when we call menstrual pain dysmenorrhea, and we divide it up into what we call primary dysmenorrhea and secondary dysmenorrhea. So usually we try to get a diagnosis, and primary dysmenorrhea is those women who start out from the get-go of their menstrual periods of having some sort of pain. Secondary dysmenorrhea, people who didn't used to have pain and somehow have developed it. And these two categories do overlap, but just for general people listening to the radio purposes, generally primary dysmenorrhea doesn't really have a specific etiology. It's more to do with the physiology of the breakdown of the menstrual lining, and I'll get back to that in a second.
Okay.
And the secondary dysmenorrhea, these are people that have some sort of cause that can be treated. Maybe they have a polyp in the lining of their uterus. Maybe they have a fibroid within their uterus. Maybe they have endometriosis. Maybe they have an infection. And if you can treat the cause, maybe you can get the dysmenorrhea to resolve. With the primary dysmenorrhea group, and it sounds like perhaps you're in that category.
In 2007, I had surgery to remove fibroids and kind of generally clean up that area.
So maybe. But what we think is that when that lining tissue breaks down, we think that the tissue itself releases what we call prostaglandin. So it's kind of weird that we treat it with the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories because, they do two things, but when the prostaglandins are released, so with the non-steroidals, you want to do two things. One, you want to give them soon enough to help prevent some of the release of prostaglandins, and then secondarily to help prevent the action of those prostaglandins. But if you're going to have a menstrual period, then to some extent, those prostaglandins will affect the pain fibers of the uterus. And most of the pain, as we have studied it, is the contraction of the uterus produced by that prostaglandin. And when we've studied the contractions at the time of menstrual pain, the contraction magnitude can be in the range of, say, 40 to 100 millimeters of mercury of pressure, whereas a cramp at the time of labor peaks at around 50 to 60. So these contractions, in fact, on a smaller scale.
Yeah.
Now, a non-pregnant uterus is about 70 grams, and a pregnant uterus is about 1,000 grams plus a baby. So, so it's a different scale, different kind of thing, lasts
sure.
a little longer. But these are very intense contractions. They're
yeah.
real. They are not fun.
No.
So
they leave me exhausted,
So there are different strategies, and it depends on who you are and where you are.
Okay.
And so So one strategy is to eliminate these forevermore, eliminate bleeding. And that's why endometrial ablations have become so popular. And one of my nurses got an email from, I think, Dr. Oz, but I don't think Dr. Oz knows my nurse, but, she got an email from Dr. Oz. And he was talking about heavy menstrual bleeding and using the NovaSure device as one of the more common devices to completely burn out the lining of the uterus so that menstrual periods are completely eliminated. Now, this is not something that someone who's planning children should ever want to do, but it can completely eliminate the lining. You don't shed it anymore. You don't have periods. Boom, no periods, no menstrual cramps.
Great.
And it's extremely effective. And not only that, but it has actually significantly reduced the number of hysterectomies that we've had to do in the United States since heavy menstrual bleeding and dysmenorrhea is a cause of hysterectomy, is the number one cause of hysterectomy each year in the United States.
Huh.
So that's one potential way. The other is to do that medically, eliminate menstrual periods some medical way with hormones. And that can be done with the Marina IUD. It can be done with the use of some sort of oral contraceptive or the timing by use of a NuvaRing, a contraceptive ring that's like taking an oral contraceptive pill or a patch. So there are hormonal ways that can be accomplished as well. Simple DNCs, things like that we used to do in the past, don't really do that because they only do what one menstrual period does, which is clean out the lining once. Uh-huh. So it really doesn't have any lasting effect. And treating pain, yes, you can treat pain, and you can treat pain more effectively. Now, there's also a medicine called transaminic acid. And again, it's more used for heavy periods rather than so much painful periods. And it's an old-fashioned medicine that's been approved in the United States for years and years and years for hemophiliacs. Hemophiliacs have better medicines to use for bleeding, but it's such an inexpensive and well-tolerated medicine that they still will give it to hemophiliacs, like if they get bleeding, like when they brush their teeth and their bloody noses, things like that. And it can actually stabilize the lining of the uterus. And for people we can't use hormones on, we use it for heavy cramping. It's using an approved medicine for a non-approved indication. And I've participated in a couple of clinical trials with it. It's a medicine that's approved in 60 countries worldwide for the use in heavy menstrual bleeding and crampy bleeding. And you just take it on your heavy day. So for you, you'd take it maybe on day 2, 3, something like that. Mm-hmm. So if you find a doctor that knows about this medicine, is willing to prescribe this medicine, it's over the counter in Sweden. But not very many American doctors use it. But that's an alternative.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Dr. Suzanne Troopen is our guest. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. Every other month she's here. We talk about women's health, always on a Monday. So questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. I want to make sure I ask a question here. Someone called in and gave this to us as an off-air question and, in fact, wanted to have you talk about the Mirena IUD.
Okay.
And specifically, I guess they were interested that in one, I guess you would say that might be an undesirable side effect, and that is weight gain. Is that, can that be an issue?
Well, we have a lot of trouble with weight gain in the United States, and I primarily practice obstetrics and gynecology, so many of my patients see their primary care doctor, and just too many of my patients come in, they're overweight, they're seeing their primary care doctor, and I'm like, have you been put on a diet? No. And, you know, we really have to be so proactive and fight our weight all the time. And if we don't, we just seem to be too sedentary. Then we struggle with the effects of high blood pressure and joint problems and arthritis problems and worse hot flashes and worse hormonal problems and so forth and so on. So even if we don't want to, be too slim, we need to fight against that at all times, no matter whether we're on hormones or not. And there was just a new study published that I think I mentioned that I might quote about weight gain in Depo Provera. And if you switch from Depo Provera completely to something non-hormonal, your weight seems to trend back to normal, but maybe not completely because we have such problems with weight gain in our population. The Mirena IUD is a hormone-impregnated IUD that leaks a little bit of progesterone locally in the uterus, and a little bit of that does get systemic uptake, but very little. And significant weight gain has not been reported with the Mirena IUD, and I would think that it would be a very good alternative for patients in that weight gain should not deter somebody with the Mirena. It's approved for 5 years of use in the United States. In many European countries, it's actually approved for 7, which I tell my patients.
Yeah.
So you might be able to eke a couple extra years out of that if you had the right doctor.
Okay. Let me just ask you about something else. I know you had some of the things that you wanted to talk about. The only reason I raise this is because, well, first of all, it's something we've talked about before. And there has been yet another study showing among Americans very serious vitamin D deficiencies.
Very serious vitamin D deficiencies. And I was just listening to one of my update tapes, and they were talking about vitamin D deficiencies in young people, college-age people. And how they were talking on this tape how to give prescription vitamin D tablets to get people up in their vitamin D levels. And there's been a lot of controversy about what is the correct vitamin D level to even have if you get your blood levels drawn. So basically, I just do a lot of talking to my patients about getting more vitamin D in tablets, you know. I believe in a lot of sun protection. The rate of melanoma has gone up in young people by 2 times. I do a lot of talking to people about genetic disease testing. There are now blood tests to test for melanoma, genetic predispositions. Again, just like with other genetic testing, just like when we test for BRCA 1 and 2, and we do earlier mammogram testing, more MRI testing, with melanoma predisposition, if you get the blood test for that, then again, you want to err on the side of suspicion, do more biopsying of suspicious looking spots on your body. And I would rather write prescription vitamin D, get people using my mineral makeup and sunscreens and treating those spots with lasers and testing their vitamin D levels. So, yes.
Well, the thing that makes me think about it is, given the fact that we continue to hear a lot of concern from dermatologists and other doctors about the hazards of sun exposure and the fact that we still seem to have the problem with that, it's kind of hard to believe that if there's a vitamin D deficiency, it's because people have suddenly started taking the advice and they're wearing a lot of sunscreen and they're staying out of the sun. And particularly given the fact that a lot of the food that we eat is enriched, cereals and breads, and they put vitamin D in milk, why should we be having such a problem with vitamin D deficiency? Are people's diets that bad?
I think that we didn't realize what vitamin D levels we need. I don't think we've enriched to the levels we need to enrich. And I think that the levels that we thought were the recommended levels were actually too low. I think that's the problem. So we're probably better than we were,
yeah,
but it's still too low in terms of the protection that we needed for bone health and so forth. Plus, we're doing so many things that are counterproductive. I'm a big diet pop offender, so I'd be the pot calling the kettle black if I told people to stay away from diet pop.
Okay.
I'm smiling.
Well, we all have
our vices.
About 5 minutes. Is there something you'd like to talk about?
I definitely were recruiting for our infertility patch study, and I can't remember if I talked about this last month. We are looking for patients that are anovulatory infertility couples with a male partner who has an adequate sperm count, if she has four or fewer menstrual cycles per year, if she's in between the ages of 18 and 38, if she has a BMI of 35 or under, and she would like to participate for a cycle in a new ovulatory medication that's delivered by a patch therapy that delivers a pulse of hormone. We would be very interested in her calling our research team at 217-356-3736. And I started my blog. People could blog me. I'm trying.
Yeah, as if you got a lot of spare time on your hands so you can work on your
blog. I know.
Blog.
I need a team.
Yeah,
I need
okay.
a team.
Maybe one other thing you said, that there is now a therapy for osteoporosis that's an IV deal, and a 15-minute treatment is good for 2 years?
Yes. Well, we have two IV therapies. Beneva, that's the once-a-month therapy that Sally Fields advertises, mm-hmm. can be given intravenously, but it's given the way it was studied was 4 times a year, and it has not been studied yet at less frequent intervals. But zoledronic acid, which is called Reclast, is an approved medicine for once a year. It's a 15-minute treatment once a year, and now there was just a new study published that the suppression of bone markers actually holds for 2 years. Mm-hmm. So it may be possible that if you received your therapy, if your bone markers are suppressed, and if your T score has remained stable, that you could actually then hold off and get your treatment every other year. So your osteoporosis therapy, instead of taking a once a week medication, you could go to an IV 15 minutes every 2 years. That'd be pretty nice.
Is this a bisphosphonate?
It is a bisphosphonate.
And though you, by doing this IV, it seems like that's a really big load. Do you then not get the nasty side effects, particularly the gastric stuff that you get when people are taking it as a pill and taking it more frequently?
People don't get those. There's a small percentage of people that get the gastric side effects. The package labeling still talks about in that first month some potential cardiac arrhythmias. You really have to load on your calcium for the next couple of weeks because it will take calcium from your bloodstream and get it into your bones. We don't completely understand the mechanism of how it's able to hold for those couple of years, probably because it binds so tightly as your bones turn over. other parts of your bones, probably take that medicine back up. And but yes, because you're not swallowing it, you do not get those GI side effects.
Okay.
It's a great alternative to consider.
Any last thing? You've got about a minute left. Any last thing you want to mention?
Okay. I thought that I would also talk about quickly a new study that showed the cost effectiveness of hysterectomy versus myomectomy or uterine artery embolization for fibroid patients. And there was actually a new article that talked about four patients who do not want children and so therefore they're not conserving their uterus for the purpose of childbearing, but that actually hysterectomy was more cost effective for the treatment of fibroids than either uterine artery embolization or myomectomy. So it might be another piece to consider when considering uterine fibroids that do need therapy. And now for patients out there listening, remember that a hysterectomy simply refers to the removal of the uterus and not to the removal of the ovaries. That's a separate issue. And we still are encouraging women under the age of 65 to consider keeping their ovaries because a new study has shown that women under the age of menopause who have had premature ovarian removal do suffer the consequences of the lack of estrogen and the lack of testosterone, and there may even be some brain effects that are detrimental as well.
All right. There, we'll leave it with our thanks to Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She's an OBGYN. She's on our program every other month on Monday to talk about women's health. Thank you very much.
Thank you.